welcome to the new series of the 2 Degrees Show, back after an absence of over a year, at a time when things are moving very fast in the area of climate change politics and solutions. Later in the series, we'll be covering the 2008 Camp for Climate Action, which this year spawns offshoots in Germany and Australia, as well as 3 camps in the United States. We'll be looking at the calls for moratoriums on biofuels and new coal developments, and much, much more besides. But we start in our traditional way by recapping some of the recent science. Today we're going to briefly revisit some of the headline conclusions of last year's IPCC report, and then consider the fact that the climate change computer models have probably been underestimating the rate of Arctic sea loss, with the latest data suggesting that there's a 50% chance that the North Pole might be ice-free this summer. We start by speaking to Joanna Hay, Professor of Atmospheric Physics at Imperial College London, who was one of the expert reviewers on the IPCC's fourth assessment report.
Why should people trust the IPCC, and what makes their judgment so credible?
Well, the IPCC is a large number of scientists who are drawn from across the world and are selected firstly for their expertise, but also for their representatives of geographical regions. And they come together and they assess all the published literature on the state of the climate and climate change. And they have meetings over a period of several years, and a lot of debate, and they write the report, and the report is reviewed by, first of all, by their peers, by other experts, then by outside scientists and governments, and then back again every time to be rewritten. It's a hugely complicated and thorough process, and nothing they can write can be outside of the refereed published scientific literature. So it's all been peer-reviewed lots of times.
Right.
So it's robust science, I think, is what I'm saying.
So perhaps we can go through some of the key headlines and changes in this latest IPCC report, which kind of came out in stages throughout last year. And it was the first report for 6 years, because the previous one was in 2001.
Yeah.
The first section deals with the warming that's been measured over the last 100 years or so. Can you say how much the world has warmed?
Well, the most robust result is the global mean surface temperature change, and that's gone up by about a few tenths of a degree over the last 150 years, which doesn't sound very much, but of course if it carries on going, then lots of more serious effects can take place. And also it's a global average, which means that there's various different effects over different parts of the globe. So the warming is larger over the land than it is at the moment, than it is over the oceans. So that the more regional you get, the less certain the results are. But it seems that there's robust warming that's been occurred over each of the individual continents. We can now say that that's a fairly reliable result, except possibly Antarctica, where there's much fewer observations available.
Okay, you say a few tenths. Can you be any more specific than that?
Since 1850, it's gone up by about 0.6 degrees.
So the question which follows really is about what's been causing the warming. What level of confidence is there now that human activity is the main cause of the warming that's been observed over the past century?
It's pretty certain, and it's certain for several different reasons. One is that the rate of warming is unprecedented in the climate record, so it's strange. That doesn't prove it's human, but it's one piece of evidence. The second piece of evidence is that we understand the physical processes whereby increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere would actually produce a warming of about the magnitude observed, and we can reproduce this in the big computer models of climate that are simulating what's going on.
I mean, so I think in the third assessment report it was reported as being likely that most of the observed warming over the last 50 years...
I think we're very likely now, aren't we?
Yeah, which is moving from between a 66 to 90% confidence to above 90% confidence?
Yes, I think that's right, yes.
Okay. Is there any serious challenges to this consensus? I mean, I'm just aware of the Observer newspaper poll, Ipsos Mori, that came out a couple of weeks ago, showing that 60% of people agreed with the following statement. Many scientific experts still question if humans are contributing to climate change.
Yes, that's very worrying, isn't it, that the public perceive that to be the case. And it must be that they're reading articles in the newspaper or the television or something that's suggesting this to them. It's certainly not true, we couldn't put a percentage on it, but I would guess it was 95% of scientists would be convinced that there's global warming and it's due to human activity. But when it's presented in the media, it's almost presented in the terms of a sort of religious belief. Either you believe it or you don't, and you can choose whether to believe it or not. And so some people believe it and some people don't, and it's almost like equally valid statements. And the fact that it's based on some sort of, you know, scientific, very serious scientific investigation seems to be lost by the wayside.
Are there any, what would you would term scientific experts that still question humans' contribution to climate change?
I don't think anybody that you could really regard as an expert disputes that there's a human influence. Now, they will argue like hell the extent of the influence, of the details of the mechanisms, and certainly regional effects. One of the most well-known of the so-called skeptics is a guy called Richard Lindzen at MIT in the United States. He's a very eminent atmospheric physicist, very, very good meteorologist, and a person who is, like many scientists, deliberately cussed, which of course is what we have to be in order to challenge all the evidence. And what he does is he thinks of as many things as he can that will challenge the consensus. And so far, everything that he's come up with has not proven to work. So it's good that people think up these ideas and challenges and we can test out our theories. But in terms of the global temperature, I don't think there's any really serious scientist could now say that it's not due to human activity.
Okay, moving on then from the kind of the observed warming over the last century to what level of global average temperature rise is predicted over the next century. There's a range of different scenarios that the IPCC use.
Yes.
What is being predicted?
Well, of course, as you say, what you get out is what you put in. So depending on what you assume about the changes in the global economy and use of carbon dioxide and other gases being emitted, you can have a very, very wide range of predictions. I think the lowest, what you might even say hoped for scenario, that the IPCC called the B1 scenario, involves a downturn in carbon dioxide emissions in the late, I think it's about 2040s or something like that, and severe cuts in emissions of carbon dioxide, which it's probably not actually feasible, but let's say we could hopefully, you know, do that. Even then, the concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere don't stabilize to about the value of, below the value of about 600 parts per million. Now, at the moment, they're 390 parts per million, and before industry kicked off, they were 290 parts per million. So you can see that's doubled, essentially, what they were pre-industrially. And that's, you know, as I say, that's the sort of weakest possible scenario, and that's going to give us a temperature, global average temperature increase of something like greater than 2 degrees. But then, of course, there's other scenarios which are possibly more realistic, in which the CO2 emissions continue to rise, and the concentrations of carbon dioxide can go up to, you know, 1,000, perhaps, that's probably a bit extreme, but 1,000 parts per million. And extreme warming, 10 degrees, something like that. So, as I say, it depends what you put in, what you get out, really.
But it's kind of worrying that you suggest that even their most optimistic scenario, the B1 scenario, suggests that we're unlikely to stay within 2 degrees C rise, which...
Other people have said that actually it's not even as good as that. I mean, of course, the range in these predictions, even if you know what the emission's going to be, the predictions rely on the quality of the models and how long you run them for. So it may be that even with that B1 low emission scenario, it won't, and under 600 parts per million concentration, it won't stabilise at 2 degrees, but carry on going on the longer time scales that are involved in, you know, deep ocean circulations and things like that.
Right.
So after, you know, thousands of years rather than hundreds of years, it could be even warmer.
Because the models are being improved all the time, I understand that the carbon cycle feedbacks have been included in the current set of models.
Yes, I mean, the models that they use for these predictions are not the state-of-the-art models, but they try and include as many of these different factors in as possible. So, as you say, carbon cycle, and they're beginning to include some of the more biological take-up effects, and take up a cup of carbon dioxide by plants and that sort of thing. But they're fairly simplistic.
Okay.
Highly parameterized.
And What other kind of so-called positive feedbacks, which are basically amplifying mechanisms, natural amplifying mechanisms, which would increase the rate of warming, have those other positive feedbacks been included in the models?
Certainly, but of course, this is where a lot of the contention arises as to how well they're included and whether everything's included.
Okay, even the... that perhaps some would argue were conservative in terms of their kind of treatment of various feedbacks. Even the current IPCC headlines for projected warming are very serious cause for concern, because the EU has argued that 2 degrees should be regarded as a dangerous level of warming, which we shouldn't exceed. And the IPCC is suggesting
essentially that's about the minimum you're going to get.
That's not possible. Even so, that's worrying.
Absolutely.
if that's the case, what are some of the impacts that we are likely to see through different temperature rises?
Well, in Europe, I mean, as I say, it's much more difficult to predict local effects rather than global mean effects. But in Europe, it seems that there's a fair degree of consensus that what will happen is that the storm tracks will move further north. And this means that the Mediterranean region will get hotter and drier, and the Northern Europe will get hotter and wetter. But the Northern Europe bit will be more important in the winter, and the Southern Europe bit will be more important in summer. Either way, there's big impacts and general warming. But I'd say those are much less certain than the sort of larger scale averages.
Okay. The Channel 4 Great Global Warming Swindle documentary, is there anything you want to pick up on there in terms of... attack on the IPCC process, saying that it's actually... screening out...
Yes, they say that any scientists that disagree with these sort of green warriors that form the IPCC are somehow excluded from the process, don't they?
Yeah.
It's absolutely... I don't know how you could describe that programme. Outrageous. I mean, not only is the science misrepresented, some of the science they presented was actually made up. It was actually cheating. And, you know, almost everything they said was distorted in some way or another. And in terms of, you know, the IPCC scientists being somehow manipulated, it's just not true. I mean, you know, all these scientists are bloody-minded. They do what they think and they say what they think, and they participate in the discussions and they like having arguments. I mean, I've been there, I've done it, I know what it's like. It's not like you're told what to think at all. You just discuss what the science is, and you come to some conclusions. And it's not always easy to come to a sort of consensus, especially when there's a wide range of results. But that's what you do, and there's no pressure on you to say one thing or another. Now, I think perhaps some of the criticism was levied at the summary for policymakers rather than at the fact, you know, report. And of course, by saying that, the sceptics are sort of getting the scientists off their back, because they say, oh, we're not criticising you, we're only criticising the sort of political types who've written the summary. But actually it's quite interesting that the summary is also being criticised by people who say that actually it was docked down to be too weak. So, you know, you've got both sides saying that it's not a good representation of what's in the big report, so I think probably we can be fairly assured that it's pretty much central down the line right.
Right, okay. As you say, there's been some kind of counter-criticism that the IPCC process produces kind of conservative science.
Yes, indeed. There is pressure on the people who write the science, the policymakers, certainly to say something that suits the governments that are funding the whole thing. So I think particularly the Chinese and American governments were putting pressure on the SPM authors, you know, not to make things sound so bad.
Yeah, I mean, there's... Just to explain to people, the scientists reach what they understand as being a summary for policymakers that they are happy with, and then that gets agreed by the scientific representatives of all the various countries involved.
Yeah.
So that is where the possible charge of political interference comes in.
Yes, it definitely involves the politicians at that stage.
Right.
You know, it goes to, you know, various civil servants or even ministers, and they don't like bits of it, and they send it back and say, can't you change that sort of thing.
Right.
And so the scientists who are then under pressure, I mean, have to try and argue their case.
Right. And things definitely do get changed, but do you think they get watered down or strengthened, as some people have defended? I think Rajendra Pachauri actually defended the process of saying sometimes that it ends up in a strengthening of the wording.
I think it goes both ways. I think it goes both ways. And, of course, part of the problem or what they're trying to do is make it a summary that's actually understood by people. It's a summary for policymakers, but it means summary for people who are not experts. So they also have to try and make it in easy language, and it's very difficult sometimes to choose precisely the correct words that mean what you want them to mean. So as you were saying earlier, what does very likely or probable or likely or unlikely, what does that actually mean in terms of statistics or, you know, percentage chances? And so there's a lot of argument about precisely which words mean what. And so, yes, it can be watered down or it can be made stronger, but I think probably the watering down tends to win because the governments are putting pressure on for, you know, it not to look so bad.
Right. I mean, the other charge that is levelled is that the IPCC process is very slow. There were 6 years between these two reports.
Yeah.
And it's just not offering policymakers what they need, what they require in terms of policy making.
That's probably true. I mean, but, you know, you can't have it both ways. Either you want it done properly, which is what they do, and it takes a long time, or you could have a couple of people writing what they think very quickly, which then wouldn't be representative of the scientific community at large.
That was Joe Hay, Professor of Atmospheric Physics at Imperial College London, and a reviewer on last year's IPCC report. The IPCC's findings represent an unprecedented case for urgent action to address an all-encompassing problem. And yet, recent observations suggest that the climate computer models they rely on have been underestimating the rate of ice loss in the Arctic. The latest data suggests that the North Pole could be ice-free as early as this summer. I picked up the story with Dr. Stuart Parkinson, Executive Director of Scientists for Global Responsibility, who took part in the review process for the IPCC's third assessment report back in 2001.
What's the time lag involved in the IPCC reports? When would the cutoff have been for the research that they were looking at in terms of the reports that came out in 2007?
What tends to happen is that they'll have a cut-off period of something like a year before publication date, but if there's some new research that comes in that they can include fairly easily, they can incorporate later stuff. But if they're halfway through a scenario projection or you know, the sea level rise projections that they've made, then they can't really incorporate new data in very easily without sort of going back and starting again. So I reckon that a lot of the stuff in the last year and a half at least won't have been incorporated in the IPCC reports.
So, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff coming out about observed changes in the ice loss in the Arctic. There was a BBC report on a study that came out in around May time 2007. I think they were saying that the actual rate of ice loss in the Arctic is about twice that shown by the IPCC models.
It is shrinking far rapidly. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that the models were predicting the Arctic to be ice-free in the second half of the century, and then the models have been revised because of the new observational data, and it's steadily crept forward, and you've got projections now of around 2013 or in the next 5 to 10 years. So yes, that's much quicker, right?
I mean, the latest thing that happened was the Independent front cover story, 27th of June, satellite data suggesting that 50% chance of the North Pole being ice-free this summer. So it could be even faster than...
Right, yes. I mean, the data I've seen on this summer is, yes, it's... We had a colder winter, so there was more ice over this winter, but it's melted more rapidly, and it's now at a thinner extent than it was last year. Mm. So, yeah, there's potential for it to be ice-free.
So, yeah. I mean, what are we starting to learn about... I guess it's called ice sheet dynamics, the way that melting occurs in the Arctic, which might be kind of or other reasons why this kind of speeding up might be occurring.
I mean, there's the basic ice albedo feedback where ice melts, and ice is very reflective, and it melts and reveals dark ocean beneath, which is not very reflective, so you get a lot more heat retained. So that's the basic process, and the trouble with a lot of models is that until you have very detailed observational data over a long period, you can't make accurate predictions, and your predictions always have a high level of uncertainty on them. And it's just because we're now getting this longer and longer time series of data, we're able to make better projections further ahead. Plus the fact that the ice sheet dynamics is a very non-linear process. So what the models that the IPCC assessment included, they didn't include a lot of the things like surface meltwater trickling down through the ice sheet and lubricating the base of the ice sheet so that it moves a lot quicker. And that process was just, there wasn't very good data, it wasn't modeled very well, and it's a lot faster than anyone thought. Then there's another process whereby the ice carves off into icebergs and disintegrates at the ocean edge. And again, that's a very non-linear process. The data's not good. It's a very difficult process to model. And the most recent observations show that that seems to be happening much faster than modelers up until then had predicted. So you've got these factors which suddenly make things look a whole lot worse. As you investigate any scientific problem, it's unless there's concerted effort in a particular area, it's very easy to just not get it quite right, and then you come up with a surprise.
But certainly, in terms of sea level rise, the IPCC will be underestimating because of the recent observations.
Yes. Well, all the studies I've seen, although I haven't seen them all by any means, but there are several studies that have come out, Hansen being one, arguing that now that we have better ice sheet dynamics incorporated into the models, now we have more observations, and particularly the last few years have really come up with much clearer observations on the ice sheet dynamics. That, yeah, we're talking about 2 to 3 times what the IPCC projection said. And it has to be, to be fair to the IPCC, they did specifically say in the summaries that this is projection not including the more uncertain ice sheet dynamics. Unfortunately, though, of course, when you start coming out with numbers, the press will grab hold of the numbers, and because it was less than the 2001 report, they were saying, oh, well, it's less to worry about, whereas really it's just saying, well, no, this is what we know with a greater degree of certainty, and the error bars were much narrower on the projections for IPCC 2007 to 2008, based on that part of the sea level rise which they had incorporated, but they did acknowledge these non-linear factors are
okay.
Going to push it out.
In terms of how that affects different areas of the world, the revised sea level increases that you're talking about now are 2 to 3 times what the IPCC report. How's that going to affect people in say China or Bangladesh, for example?
I haven't got clear numbers, and I haven't seen clear numbers about how many extra million. 2 to 3 times is going to be around double the number of people affected, particularly in areas which are very highly populated already, and it's going to be East China and East Coast of China and Bangladesh, the Nile Delta, and a couple of other parts of Southeast Asia that are vulnerable as well. So, yeah, yes, I mean, you are looking at multiplying the number of people you have to defend or relocate or who are just going to get hit. The number I've got here is that the sea level rise in China, sea level rise of 0.5 meter would inundate a coast where 30 million people currently live. And I mean, that is a very densely populated area, and another 0.5 meter or more is going to add a few tens of millions onto that number.
That was Dr. Stuart Parkinson, Executive Director of Scientists for Global Responsibility, and a reviewer on the IPCC report back in 2001. There's more from Stuart next week, when we'll discuss the recent satellite data that indicates dramatic mass loss from the West Antarctic ice sheet, as well as looking at how so-called positive feedbacks, or accelerating processes, have been incorporated in the climate computer models, and whether, in the light of the recent work by the US's leading climate scientist James Hansen about what might constitute a safe level of global average temperature rise, we need to retitle this programme the 1.7 degrees show or the 0.5 degrees show. In the meantime, I recommend taking a look at the IPCC's fourth assessment report summaries for policymakers, particularly the section which deals with projected impacts, which we have not dealt with here, and which are available for download from the IPCC's website. And for other links and references relating to the material in this programme, go to the Climate Radio website at www.climateradio.co.uk. There you can listen to this show again, or to any of the other programmes from the Climate Radio archive. And I'll leave you with the words of the IPCC chairman, Rajendra Pachauri. If there's no action before 2012, that's too late. What we do in the next 2 or 3 years will determine our future. This is the defining moment.